If I mess this all up, I'll be properly chastised. Of all the great world teachers, I suppose Gautama Buddha came the nearest to being a psychologist in the modern sense of the term. He was deeply involved in the entire phenomenon of mentality. And to him, the mind was often the slayer of the real. And today, we have lost much of our natural interest in the functions of our own minds. We take mentality for granted. We are assuming that we have certain mental allotments of abilities or debilities, and we must live with them. It is not, however, always possible for the individual to chart his own mental course of thought and action. And this morning it seems that it might be interesting to consider how the individual could be his own psychologist, how he could do for himself certain services which he now pays rather handsomely to have someone else perform for him. We have long taken the attitude that we must never do things that we can pay someone else to do. But now, with the present high cost of living and the cost of high living, we are reviving in some of our natural individuality. The mind, according to Buddhism, is a machine very much like a native natural computer. The mind computerizes not as the result of a mechanical structure, but as a result of a living, vital integration of values and processes and resources. The mind is a living instrument. It is not something that you turn on and off. It's not something you buy spare parts for. It is, however, a constantly functioning, ordering mechanism. It has the power of recording and perpetuating records. It can bring out things that are long forgotten. It can accomplish the most interested and most involved processes in memory, thought, things of this nature. So it really is a tremendous instrument in its own right. To use this instrument, perhaps it is best, again, to see how Buddha summed the matter up. He points out that the mind itself has six essential functions. It is a machine. It is not the soul. It is not the spirit. It is part of the structure that has been created to protect the human being in his mortal existence in the kind of world we live in now. It is therefore a defensive organism to protect the body, the emotions, and all of the processes of daily living. It is a defense against fear, against worry, against grief. It helps us to achieve judgments and honesties that would not otherwise be possible. Therefore, the mind is a very happy and healthy part of our economy. Now, Buddha tells us that the five sensory perceptions that we all know, sight, hearing, taste, feeling, and the general structure of the body itself, hearing, all these faculties are parts of a machine. And as parts of a machine, each has an independent existence. Sight has its own world, a world of processes, a world of intricate interrelationships. The faculty of sight is one of the most extraordinary faculties in the worlds of creation. Things seen, therefore, become very important, and a great many human beings live almost totally dependent upon this one faculty. Everything that they see, they believe. And without some outside and additional help, seeing can be a treacherous and dangerous thing. Because seeing is only one part of an instrument for accumulating knowledge. And if this part is developed beyond all others, it can result in an individual living almost completely on the surface of the phenomenal universe. In addition to this, the second, probably most important of our faculties, is hearing. Hearing and seeing together are used probably for 90% of our judgments. Hearing enables us to learn. It enables us to communicate with each other. It enables us to develop a variety of arts. It has given us music, and it has given us poetry. Hearing is a very important phase of knowledge. Hearing is also the source of a great deal of unfortunate pressure. Hearing, for instance, has enveloped in modern rock music, can be a very deadly thing and has been held responsible for a great deal of sickness among small children. The problem of noise means a process of sound which does not contribute to progress but ends in confusion and very largely the degeneration of a faculty. Therefore, it is up to the individual who learns to see thoughtfully to also hear thoughtfully and to combine these two faculties for the advancement of his general insights. In addition to this, of course, we have specialized faculties, such as taste. The power to taste various flavors can be defensive. It can prevent us from taking a great many poisons into the system. But taste is also a tyrant in its own right when separated from all other sensory perceptions. Taste can give us the epicure. It can give us the individual to whom food and drink are the most important things in the world. Taste also is a first line of resistance to nutritional balance. It helps us to keep on eating things that are not good for us. And if taste is allowed to run its own course without discipline by any other faculty, it can lead us into all kinds of physical dilemmas. So we have to give it only proper consideration. The sense of smell is also a very useful aid to things, and it is particularly strong in the development of the animal world. The animal depends upon scent for a great deal more than we do. But even with the human being, pleasant odors, perfumes, incense, and things of this nature are a pleasure to the individual. And sense of smell also warns of decay, deterioration, and various unhygienic circumstances which can cause trouble. Therefore, it also is one of the guardians of the body, the mind, and the emotions. The sense of feeling is also rather generally considered. Today, we are not as acute in feeling as we used to be. But even now, very few people will buy an expensive article without touching it. They want the communication of the feel of fabrics. Gradually, this can become so skillful that the quality of all kinds of wools, silks, and synthetic materials can be instantly estimated. The sense of feeling also gives us the study of surfaces and many different things that can be obstructions or dangerous to us. Feeling can tell us when we have something in our hands that is sharp or could injure us. So all of these faculties have their own particular power to help us in living. Now, Buddha points this out without question, and he says these things are all true. But what happens? What happens when these five senses all go their own ways? each one doing exactly according to its own most natural or abnormal instinct. Supposing the individual tries to cater to all five of them, this could be a rather complicated situation. So nature has also given us what Buddha calls the most important of all the sensory perceptions, a sixth sense, which is called the mental coordinator. Now, a coordinator in any field of activity is usually a person who must try to keep the peace, must try to make things work together, must learn to harmonize dissonances, and must finally become the director of this symphonic pattern of sensory perceptions. So the mental coordinator is the sensor. It is that which demands the right to bring faculties into proper order and relationships. The mental coordinator must therefore, first of all, be accepted as a leader and must then be catered to, in a sense, or kept in a state of constant information concerning the functions of the five sensory perceptions. The coordinator must know what they are doing and make sure that they are not doing that which will injure themselves or break up the unity and pattern of the mental integration. Now, nearly all mental difficulties in this world are due to misunderstandings or misinterpretings of sensory reflexes or sensory observances. The individual is constantly struggling with one sensory faculty against another. Now, one of the Greeks, of course, pointed out that the deadly enemy of any sensory perception is what might be termed some type of opinionism. It is something by means of which a single faculty is catered to, is given precedence over all the others, and the other faculties are used not to make a contribution, but to support the attitude which is already held in the mind. Therefore, most people in their thinking are more concerned in trying to prove that they are right than to find out what right is. Also, nearly all of the mental and emotional functions defend attitudes, defend opinions, defend prejudices, and contribute to the continuation of destructive memory patterns. The memory is not skilled, is not trained. But now we look around to see what it all adds up to. We see this thing we call the human brain. We see it connected to the outside world by certain sensory bands. We see it sitting enthroned among the testimonies of the parts of itself. The five senses are all parts of the brain-mind. They are more than simply physical factors. They are psychological, chemical processes going on in the mind. So the mind looking out through the eyes sees all kinds of things, some of which interest him and others disturb him. Looking out today through the eyes, he has the privilege of enjoying the television, radio, and news media. After listening to it for a while, he is so sick he is practically ready to go to bed. But the eyes bring him all of this material through a secondary series of eyes, such as motion pictures and television. The mind, therefore, is constantly bombarded, and the factor of sight is continually reporting conditions that gradually come into prominence through visualization. The eyes result in the visualization of virtue and of vice. There is visualization of violence, crime, there is all kinds of negative testimony, and there are also what we all hope for and look for, benevolent testimonies. But the eyes in this case create by themselves a way of life or a series of convictions which are at the moment afflicting a large part of the human race. These are the uses of visual imagery to perpetuate attitudes that are essentially wrong. Now, the person, if he uses his mental coordinator, must naturally censor what he sees. Without censorship, the faculty of sight can lead to terrible disasters. So he must learn to censor his own seeing. And in order to censor his own seeing, he has to go back again to the mental coordinator. For this gives him a series of cooperative internal functions, such as experience, memory, tradition, religion, philosophy, and common sense. Now, common sense in Buddhism would be the common testimony of the five senses. It means that they are all having their say. They are all proving what they can prove about themselves and each other. Also, the common sense carries within it the superstructure of the sixth sensory perception power, the coordinator. So when you see something on television, on the street corner, or wherever you see it, memory begins to associate with this. Where have you seen something similar before? Where have you read about it? Where have you studied the meaning of it? What do you know or believe concerning the merit or demerit of the process that you are considering? If the coordinator is functioning and the mind is normal and proper, it will censor itself. The mind can prove, for example, that similar things have happened to you in the past, and when you treated them properly, they improved. When you mistreated them, they got worse. So wherever a new incident arises, the coordinator, like the computer, will bring into focus previous knowledge concerning these things or that particular thing. This process is almost instantaneous. And therefore, it passes as a thought or a remembrance or something that we knew but had not noted lately. Actually, therefore, through the media of the sensory perceptions, we bring in all kinds of testimonies. Through the eyes, we also bring in the printed page. We bring in the book that we plan to read or have read. And we are confronted instantly, more or less, with the estimation of the meaning of that book. Is it a good book? Is it a useful one? Or is it a trashy publication? And then comes the moral question of why do we like it? Do we like it because it is a superior achievement? Is it a literary masterpiece? Or do we like it because it plays to some negative attitudes in ourselves? Do we pick it because it is a sensational work? Or do we pick it because it is instructive and valuable to our lives? The whole field of fiction, therefore, comes also into focus. Fiction is more relevant than we may realize. Fiction is very often simply a verbal form of symbolism. Fiction may be an imaginary situation based upon circumstances that could be true, and the end of these circumstances is a situation that might exist. In Tibet, for example, there is no fictional literature. These people have never believed in fiction. They have wonderful legendary, all kinds of allegories, fables, and moral writings. They have wonderful fairy tales and so forth, but these things are not considered fiction. If they have a foundation in some integrities, if they picture something that is real and important, then they are worth reading. If they cater only to sensationalism in ourselves or in some way to superficial instincts, they're not worth reading. So the Tibetans have the simple statement, if it isn't true, don't read it. This, and you might say, if it isn't true, don't look at it. Because the more you take in things that are untrue, the more you may be influenced by them. And unless the mental coordinator steps in and proves to you conclusively that this is imagination, this is fiction, you become over-influenced with something that is not true. The coordinator, therefore, comes in wherever a problem arises. And the problems that arise are quite similar to those that many persons take to their psychiatrist or psychologist. They take their problems to try to be guided toward a solution. Now, the only reason, probably, that they choose someone else to become their coordinator is because the mysterious mental integrator is weak in themselves. The machine of the six senses is weak in the coordinator, which should bring all information into balance and integrity. Now, we are learning from computerization that there is an incredible amount of information can be stored on a small disk of paper. We are learning all kinds of things which prove to us the absolute incredibility of the recording of various types of information. And yet the computer is nothing in comparison to the human psychological organization itself. The computer has given us certain knowledge, but it is the individual's own integrations and integrities that have given us the great patterns upon which computerization is based. So here we have someone going for help. They're going for help because of one of numerous circumstances. They are going to seek help, of course, basically, because they're in trouble, or undecided, or uncertain of a course of action. They do not go if they know exactly what they intend to do. Of course, some often try to bluff their way even through psychological conferences to force their opinion upon the psychologist or psychiatrist. But for the most part, these people are confused, they're upset, they realize they are not using their faculties properly, and they hope that someone outside of themselves will substitute for the coordinator, the power of bringing it to common sense within themselves. Now, each person has a possibility of looking over his own nature to determine very largely what his problems are and how they can be handled. There is no problem that arises in human life that cannot be handled. Some of the handling will be difficult, some of it painful, but it can be done. And for the most part, the sooner it is done, the less painful it will be. Now, we have several codes. Buddhism had its Ten Commandments, which are a little different in their wording, inasmuch as some of them are for the laity and some are for the clergy. The Mosaic Code of the Ten Commandments, the Sermon on the Mount, the ethical codes of Confucius, the ancient beliefs of most peoples, India, China, Japan, Korea, American Indians, Aztec, Maya, Toltec civilizations, all of these were built upon codes. Codes that are very important. Codes like the Code of Hammurabi, the oldest moral code we know. The Justinian Code, all the way down to the Code Napoleon. These codes tell us certain truths. And for the most part, people in trouble have violated a code. Very few have violated a code they never heard of. Nearly everyone who has violated a code is aware that they have departed from a pattern which has long been established as reasonable and normal. Nearly everyone who has violated a moral, ethical code must accept the inevitable consequence. He goes to a psychiatrist or psychologist to be told what was the mistake and how he must try to correct it. He knows the mistake himself, but he believes that he has not the power, the will, the courage, or the strength to correct it himself. And also he believes in a mysterious abracadabra in a science called psychology, which will work miracles that he cannot work all by himself. Most of this thinking itself is very poor, but it is quite common. Having decided in his own mind that a person is unhappy, the problem comes to find out why. And in looking into himself, the five-sensory machine can bring him a great deal of present testimony and former testimony. He will learn, as Buddha points out, that the problems all began within himself. And then, because they began within himself, he moved about into the environment around him, causing this environment to be deformed by the pressures from within himself. And then these inner pressures that have been brought out into the environment are returned again as problems into the individual who began the cycle in the first place. In other words, nearly every problem we know in life is some kind of a bird that's come back to us to roost. It is our own bird. Now, many people realize this, and we have all kinds of repentant people who wish they hadn't done what they did do, and repentance then goes into the coordinator to find what's going to come out. And in every instance in which an honest question is asked, and the individual will accept honesty, the honest answer will come from within himself. The only thing someone else can do for him is to reiterate or strengthen the realization of his own answer. We are the cause of our problems, and all the business about there being curious circumstances, phenomena, mysterious, unreal pressures, all this is simply evasion. The individual is in the midst of pressures which require his own solution. He must do what is necessary. In the business world, this is rather obvious today. A person who wishes a good job must study and get the necessary skills to make that job possible. If he has the proper skills, he will find the job. If the individual with problems has the proper internal integration, he will solve his own problems, unless his condition has deteriorated to the degree that the mind itself is completely sickened. All the superficial decisions depend upon this division between what we want to do and what we should do. And unless these are the same thing, we're in trouble. We must want to do that which is next for us. We must want to do that which accomplishes the greatest good for all concerned. But selfishness stepping in unbalances this whole situation. And selfishness is supported by the testimony of the five senses through a series of intricate delusions. It is created by interpreting into everything on the outside the vices that we ourselves are nursing inside of ourselves. We take, for example, that we are entitled to cheat others because someone else is cheating us. This philosophy of life leads to an endless cycle of crime and sorrow. The individual is only secure when he's right. He is only right when he is fulfilling the highest level of integrities of which he is capable. Now, the higher levels of integrities for many people are locked within these mysterious psychological disks, which can be brought out only when need arises. Every problem that arises, to some way, in some degree, will be answered from within the person, for things cannot happen to him that he is incapable of understanding. There are many things happening that he doesn't want to understand. There are things that he has been told by other people that he can't understand. He has been told that the only answer is to go to someone else who doesn't understand him to find out what is wrong with him. So the cycle goes on indefinitely. The one benefit that comes out of this whole situation, therefore, is faith. Faith is the belief that somebody else can do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Faith, in its way, is a very valuable power. But faith should always be used to prove that we have the strength to overcome weakness, whatever it may be, in our own integration. The worrier is a person who has allowed the negative mental mechanisms to take over. Everything he sees adds to his worries, and nothing adds to solution. The next person in the same environment finds that he is aided and strengthened for all kinds of decisions. And on the same planet, with the same society, with the same world problems and conditions, all kinds of people in all degrees of development are living out constructive destinies on the one hand or destructive ones on the other. And they're all in the same environment. We are all part of a pattern. Now, it may well be that coming into this pattern, we intuitively and instinctively realize there's something wrong with it. This is probably one of the most fundamental lessons that we learn from the machine of the sensory perceptions. It shows us crime. It shows us dishonesty. It reveals to us lack of integrity. It tells us beyond all doubt about the intolerances and cupidities of human nature. So we see the situation, and we also realize that we must make some adjustment to it. Now, the adjustment that most likely suggests itself arises from the mental faculty that observes the problem. If it's something we have seen, the faculty is very apt to say, do what you see others do. They are doing it, therefore, under existing conditions, you must do it too. Now, this produces nothing. It only means that twice as many people are in trouble. No one gains anything by making mistakes on the grounds that other people make them. Now there comes a question. How are we going to avoid these mistakes? Well, in the old system of Buddhism, back in what is called the Hinayana, or small vehicle, the only way to get away from these mysterious mistakes was to simply walk out of them. The monk renounced the world, left family and kin, went out into the wilderness or the desert somewhere, and lived by himself in a hut. In the early Christian mysticism, the same situation prevailed. Those who wanted to escape the sins of the world simply moved out. They went to some deserted place or joined the monastic order and spent the rest of their lives transcribing manuscripts or painting icons. They left the world behind and refused to be part of it. Now, this was all right to those who had been trained in East Indian asceticism. It was a different kind of world then. Nobody can really say that these people who walked out on everything really grew very much. They sort of protected their virtues by never testing them. But as time went on, about 100 BC, approximately, in Buddhism there was a new movement called the Mahayana, or the Great Vehicle. And this was represented by a new attitude toward life, in which those who sought to develop a virtuous career did not depart from society, but began the quiet process of gaining the internal strength to dedicate thought, emotion, and effort to constructive purposes. The Hinayana sought salvation for itself. The Mahayana sought the salvation of all that lives. Therefore, Mahayana became the great heart doctrine of Asia. It was a doctrine of compassion, of forgiveness, of living quietly in the midst of problems and dedicating every available resource to the service of human need. This did not mean that the individual departed from his daily pursuits. It did not mean that the householder left his family. It did not mean that he no longer wanted to find reasonable employment because it was part of a sinful world. To the Mahayanist, his doctrine was one of inward dedications manifesting themselves through actual services to human need. The main point in Buddhism, both schools, that we have to bear in mind is the egocentricity of the attitude that the individual is trying desperately to be perfect, that everything must be sacrificed to the spiritual growth of the individual himself. This is contrary to Buddhism, because they believed that this type of attitude was a superior kind of selfishness, in which the person was perfectly willing to neglect the world to save himself, or perfectly willing to go out and attain illumination and let the rest of the world suffer. To meet this particular mystery of action, the Mahayana school developed what was called the doctrine of the bodhisattvas. The bodhisattvas were persons who gradually, over a number of lives, through service to others, through dedications to truth, to absolute self-forgetfulness, came to the highest possible relationship with the mortal world. The only step beyond the bodhisattva was going to go back into the great causal universe from which we all came. So the bodhisattva always stood at the gate of the eternal. He had no further to go. There was nothing that he had not conquered within his own nature. There was no selfishness, self-interest, or egotism, no spiritual ambition, nothing of this kind. There was only complete acceptance of the world, of the truth, and infinite compassion for all that lives. So in this moment, the bodhisattva has to make the great decision whether to go on to eternal rest or to go back and labor in the world for the common good. Those who did this in the Buddhist Mahayana system were considered the greatest of all. They came back to the world, took on the illusion of life, but lived to serve only the great causes that were worthy of their support and insight. The bodhisattva doctrine, therefore, was an obligation that no individual would seek ultimate liberation from the world until he could take the whole world with him. This is the idea that caused Northern Buddhism to become probably the greatest moral force in Asia, a force that was warm and kind, no tyranny, no intolerance. Buddhism never condemned another faith. It only condemns the individual who does not live a faith that he claims. And even this condemnation is very light and passing. There is no time to worry about all these mistakes. The time has come to leave them behind and do that which is next. Now, most people live in a comparatively small world. They live in family, among friends in a locality. They have a job. They have certain recreations. They have married children and grandchildren, all this type of thing. They live in small worlds, and these small worlds are symbols of a greater world. The family is the symbol of creation itself. It is the symbol of the universe. Friends are almost like other cosmic systems that are close to us in one respect or another. But it is in this comparatively quiet environment that each individual, according to Buddhism, must work out his own salvation with diligence. Those were the last words of Gautama Buddha before he entered the Nirvana. We must all work out our own salvation with diligence. This salvation does not have to be glamorous. It does not have to be enormous. It does not have to be something that changes the course of universal destiny. It is the individual proving that in the place where he finds himself, he can achieve victory over his own fears, his animosities, his antagonisms, his false ambitions, and the various failings of jealousy and greed. It is actually the test. The Greeks and the Egyptians considered the family an initiation. So did Confucius. The family was the great symbol of human growth. And if the family is secure, as Confucius pointed out in his Analects, if the family is secure, it supports the state. If the state is pure and true, it supports the nation. If the nation is right, it supports the universe. All of these attainments arise from the simple fulfillment of the proper destiny for the individual. We therefore have at our disposal, in our own family lives, in the daily associations, five valuable sensory perceptions that can point out to us what we need to know immediately, here and now. These faculties may not be sufficiently strong to support us into the unknown future. But to the Buddhist, there is no unknown future. That is a point that is very important. There is no unknown future because every individual knows his future, whether he realizes it or not, the moment he commits action. The future must necessarily be the fulfillment of the causes which he himself has set into motion. The future, therefore, is as good as he is now and as difficult as he is now. Having come to some such a thought as this, the problem of how to work it out more constructively is to make better use of all of these faculties with which we are endowed. We must learn to see that which it is best for us to see. This does not mean that we do not observe things that are not best, but because of inner integration, we cling to those things which are best. We see things that we wish were not that way. If it is within our power to change them, we do so. But as Francis de Assis pointed out, what we cannot change, we must endure with spiritual insight. So the individual, in his home life and so forth, and it is in this area, usually, that he goes to the psychologist. He goes to the psychiatrist not because he is worrying over the fate of the Afghanistans. He is going because he's having trouble right now in his own life. His job is threatened. His family is breaking up. His home is weak. He doesn't sleep well. He isn't eating well. The body is beginning to show the wear and tear of intemperance. He has tried to escape through alcohol, narcotics, or tobacco, and he's still sick. All these things are immediate personal things. Now, no individual is born into this world who does not possess the power to correct himself or govern himself if he so desires. This is clearly pointed out by Thomas Aquinas, that all these things are within the control of the individual. But to control himself, the individual has to go against a certain kind of pleasure that arises from breaking rules.